preaching out of the first two chapters of Job, mainly, quite a while back, probably a couple of years ago. It was my normal Bible reading. I read through Job, and I thought, yeah, I really want to understand the arguments. I really want to understand what's going on here. And so I read through it again and again and again, and especially, particularly their arguments, to see if I could understand them. And it's very interesting things, but there's a lot to Job that speaks to us now, that speaks to us in this day and age in which we live. And so I want to go through the story of what happened, the phenomenal story of what happened with Job. And so let's begin with verse 1 of chapter 1. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. There were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He possessed 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 female donkeys, and very many servants, so that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. His sons used to go and hold feasts in the house of each one on his day, and they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And when the days of the feast had run their course, Job would send and consecrate them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings, occurring according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that in thy children that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did continually. And what we have here is a sort of a macro view of what's going on. The others involved did not necessarily have this view, but we get an understanding thanks to the writer who wrote this, and we don't really know who wrote the book of Job. I like to think it's Elihu, but there's absolutely no evidence for that, and I can't say that. It's just an interesting thought. But at any rate, what we see here is established right away at the very beginning, the very first verse, a critical piece of knowledge that you have to understand. It says, there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. So right away we have an understanding of who Job is. And of course, you read through Job, you know the story, you know that there, for the next, for I think it's 34 chapters, there's going to be an argument going on between Job and really 4 other people involved who would have different ideas about why this is happening, why these trials are happening in Job, and that those arguments will center around Job. You're a sinful man. You're an evil man. You've done some sinful thing that has caused these trials to happen to you. So we have that critical piece of evidence right up front. We know that Job is in fact a blameless man. He's upright. He fears God. We see that Job is also a man who God has blessed enormously. He is incredibly wealthy. He has a lot of wealth. He has many servants and many cattle and many fields, and this man is doing very well. God has blessed him enormously. But we also see that he's a man who's jealous for the holiness of God. He has a family who is a loving family. This is interesting. His family love one another. The siblings love one another. 7 boys and 3 girls who all love to be with each other and who care for one another and love to be around. Isn't that a wonderful thing to have? And Job is so jealous for the holiness of God that when they're together and they're eating and drinking, that maybe some thought of God would come across their mind, that God isn't necessary, or that they might sin against God in their thoughts in some way. And so Job is so jealous for the holiness of God that he performs sacrifices for them, and just in case they might have sinned. And no doubt he got with them and let them know, and he knew exactly what he was doing. And he warned them, be careful in what you do. Preserve the holiness of God. Think of him and worship him. And so he did this continually. And then we see also in chapter 29 when Job is defending himself, against accusations, we see what kind of a man he really was too. And it's out of his words, but he says, I delivered the poor who cried for help, and the fatherless who had none to help him. The blessing of him who was about to perish came upon me, and I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. I put on righteousness, and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and a turban. I was eyes to the blind and feet to the lame. I was a father to the needy, and I searched out the cause of him whom I did not know. I broke the fangs of the unrighteous and made him drop his prey from his teeth. Further down in verse 21, it says, men listened to me and waited and kept silent for my counsel. After I spoke, they did not speak again. And my word dropped upon them. They waited for me as for the rain, and they opened their mouths as for the spring rain. I smiled on them when they had no confidence. And the light of my face they did not cast down. I chose their way and sat as chief, and I lived like a king among his troops, like one whom comforts mourners. Job, we also see that Job is an incredibly kind and generous man who looked on the concerns of others and cared for them. Job had many servants. I think he loved them. I think he knew them well and cared for their families and was a man who was considered very wise. When he walked into the gate to where the other wise men were, they listened to him. He had the last word. They were silent when he spoke because they knew that he's a wise man and his wisdom comes from God, and they listened to him. This is the kind of man that Job was. This we know right off at the beginning. But then there, as we go on in verse 6, it says, now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, from where have you come? And Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it. And the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil? Even God's own words declare Job a righteous man. And so we see that there came a day when Satan appeared before God, and I think Satan was summoned before the king. And Satan answered the king's question, where have you been? What have you been doing? And Satan told him what he'd been doing, roaming the earth, walking to and fro. He didn't say, I think, what his real purpose was, but it was known. His real purpose was seeking someone to devour, seeking someone to destroy. And then God does an amazing thing. God says to the lion, the roaring lion, have you considered Job? A man who's upright, a man who praises God, and that's quite a thing that God did. It's like a thief coming into a store, and the owner says, "If you consider the most valuable things that I have in the store over here, here they are." And so God asked Satan if he considered Job, and that's kind of a funny question. Yes, God knows that Satan has considered Job. He knows very well who Job is and despised him. And he also knows that God has protected Job. And then Satan answered the Lord and said, does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. Satan knows very well where the blessings have come to Job. They've come from God. He's protected Job so that no one can get at him. No one can harm him. No one can take his possessions or his wealth or his family. But then Satan says, but stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face. And you think about that. That's a vile insult. What Satan is really saying to God is the only reason he likes you, God, the only reason he praises you, because you give him good things. You bless him. That's the only reason. It's not because of you. It's because of the blessings that you give him, the good things that you lavish on him. Of course he blesses you, but take those things away and oh, his tune will change real quickly. Then he'll curse you. That's a terrible insult. And the Lord said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. And in the next verses we see it, what Satan did. It says also, now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine and in their oldest brother's house. I think that's there for a very important reason. There was a day. There was a day when God summoned the angels to come before him, and Satan came among them. And there was a day that that the sons of Job were eating and drinking. I think what's being said here is that Satan has very cleverly picked a day. He's picked a time for his attack. He didn't just do it carelessly. Satan is a clever and a vicious enemy. And he knows when to attack. He knows when we're at our weakest. He knows when our concern is the greatest. And so he picked a day when he knew that Job's thoughts would be on his children. Because now they're gathered together at his oldest son's house and they're eating and drinking. And Job's thoughts would be with them. His prayers would be with them. And his concerns would be with them. And that's the day that Satan picked. And there came a messenger to Job and said, picture Job in his home or outside his home, and he's standing there, and a messenger comes running up to him. And when people are coming running to your home in that day, you know that they're bringing you an important message. You don't run up to the home with some trivial thing. He has an important message to bring. And probably Job saw in his face that this was a sad message. And so a messenger came to Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabines fell upon them and took them and struck them down the servants with the edge of the sword. And I alone have escaped to tell you. And while he was yet speaking, there came another and said, the fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them. And I alone have escaped to tell you. And while he was yet speaking, there came another and said, the Chaldeans formed three groups and made a raid on the camels and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword. And I alone have escaped to tell you. And I know that at this time, Job has seen these men running up to him one after another in line. And Job no doubt sees that fourth man running up to him. Job also knows that by now that all of his wealth, all of his possessions, his many servants who I think were his friends too, have been stolen or killed. And all is taken away. The only thing that he has left now, he is well aware, are his children, his seven sons and three daughters. And he knows they're together. And he sees that fourth man running up to him. And oh, how his heart must have jumped within him. Oh, how the sorrow must have already come upon him, knowing what's happening, knowing what's going to come next. And so this fourth man, comes running up to Job and he says, your sons and your daughters are eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And behold, a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house. And it fell upon the young people, and they are all dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you. We cannot imagine the sorrow, the pain that must have happened to Job, that must have come upon him at this time. It's unimaginable. I can't fathom it. If you've ever lost a loved one unexpectedly, you get a taste of that. Job lost his seven sons and three daughters. Job lost all of his wealth, all of the possessions that God had given him, and many friends, they're all dead. They're all taken from him. I cannot imagine the heartache that he experienced at this time that happened to him. You know, we sometimes we tend to be a bit callous in how we look at things, and especially if you've lost a loved one unexpectedly like this, and people will often say, and I remember when Kelly, Shelley's sister, and her nephews were killed, and we had some people say, well, it's been a month, time to get over it, and go on. Amazingly, that was even said to Mike, her husband, who survived that get over these things and move on. But it doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way at all. Job never, as long as he lived, forgot about those seven sons and those three daughters or the friends that he lost. Never did. No doubt there's always times when he remembered them and his heart was broken for them, that he cried out, probably many times. And that's the way we are. That's the way we should be. We should mourn these things. It should cause great grief to us, and it did, no doubt, to Job. It caused him great grief, unimaginable grief. And we know because we have a picture of what happened. The writer gave us a picture, an overall macro view of what's going on in this event that Job did not have, or anybody else. We know that these things are caused by the hand of God. Now, Job knew that, but he had no idea why. And he had no idea what was going on, behind the scenes with this. But we know that there were a great many angels, a host of the sons of God were watching this thing to see what would happen, because there was a test going on. There was a testing of Job, and Satan had made his boast that he could destroy this child of God, that he could cause him to curse God and despise him, and so now we wait to see what would happen. But then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell on the ground and worshipped. Job fell on the ground and worshipped God. What an incredible thing is that. He worshipped God after the loss of all that he had, the things that he valued so much on earth, his beloved sons and daughters who loved him and he loved them, all gone, but yet he fell on the ground and worshipped God. Is that not amazing? I can only imagine at that time when this happened that a multitude of angels shouted out praise to God and glory to God and worship him and sang his praises for his mighty work that he did in Job. And Job worshiped God, and Job said, "The Lord has taken away, the Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Blessed be his holy name." What an amazing thing to see. What an amazing event to occur at that time. And then Satan went away, and we don't hear any more of him, at least for a time. Tendency when we read things like this is because all this happened, and we see all this in just one short chapter, less than a page, we see all these great events. And so our tendency when we read these things is to sort of take them as if they happened very quickly. And certainly the loss that Job suffered did happen very quickly. It all happened in one evening. But Job lingered under this, the loss that he had, I think, for some time, because in the next chapter it says, "Again there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord." I think the indication here is that this was some time down the road, that this was not the next day, this was not the next week, maybe, or even the next month. I think this went on for quite a long time after this happened. And I don't know. I can't say it. But I suspect that because Satan is so clever, that the next events happen maybe on even an anniversary of the death of his sons. But at any rate, we see that there came another time when the Lord summoned them all before him, and Satan came among them too. And again, the Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" And Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil? He still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason." And then Satan answered the Lord and said, "Skin for skin, all that a man has, he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face." And pause there for a moment. Think about that. Satan knows us. He knows how we think. He knows what motivates us and what we take joy in. And I think he's very clever here. Years ago, we attended a church service with family, and it was a fairly large church. And the pastor gave a sermon, and he asked the audience, he said, "What do you value the most in this world? What's most important to you?" And he literally asked the audience, "What is it that's most important to you?" And there, I don't know how many people he asked, seven or so, something like that. And I expected them to say, "Well, God is the most important thing in my life." But amazingly, not one person said that. Some of them said family is the most important thing to them. But most of them said my health. My health is the most important thing to me. As long as I have my health, I'm happy. That's the thing that's most important to me. I was stunned to hear that. But Satan knows. He knows what people value. And so Satan said, "Okay, I did not win that first battle, but take away his health. He's still happy. He's still healthy. He's still able to function. But you take that away from him. You take away his health, and you cause him pain, and then he'll curse you for sure, because that's where his value is." And so Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. God gave Satan again enough leash to go out and do that. And so Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. We read that in one verse, and you understand that certainly it was a bad disease that Satan struck Job with. But Satan is brutal and he's cruel. He's not going to hold anything back. He's going to go as far as he can possibly go to cause pain and injury. And so this disease, whatever it was that he gave to that was brought about, and really God did it. But what happened to Job was a ferocious disease. And sometimes I've heard, in fact, not long ago, I heard a pastor preach. He had some kind of an illness and a cancer, I think it was, and he said it was the same, no doubt, the same disease that Job had. Well, I really doubt it. What Job had was a loathsome and filthy and vile disease. In fact, we don't have a lot of information on it, but we do have some clues. Job himself said that his skin blistered over, and it was full of pus and worms, and that it would turn black and crack and fall off, and then when skin would grow underneath it, it would blister and be filled with pus and worms and crack and fall off again. And so we know that the disease he had was a horrible disease, and it stunk. And if you've ever been around someone who's had maybe multiple boils or some kind of a disease in some way like that, you know it stinks. It's awful. Job was in pain. And he sat on the ground and he took a piece of broken pottery and he scraped his wounds. He scraped the pus and the worms out of his wounds using that. Oh, what misery the man must have been in. when this happened to him and the pain that he endured. I cannot imagine it. And then it says, and then Tad even further injury. We go on in verse 9. It says, then his wife said to him, do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. And we see that even his wife, she just could not take any more. And it was too much for her to continue on. And she, and what really I think is what she's saying here is, Job, you're dying. Give it up. Go. Die. Just say, God, take me. I'm done. Take my life. I want it no more. I can stand no more. Die, Job. You're too hard on her. You have to consider that this woman also lost her 7 sons and her 3 daughters. She also saw all the possessions of the family gone and disappeared. Her friends also died and left them. And what we also know from Job's words, we know that even his own family and friends in the area left him. They didn't want anything to do with him either. It was too much, and they all left. And this woman had also endured those things too, along with Job. And now she sees Job, her husband, who no doubt she loved, suffering greatly with this horrible disease. And she just could not take it anymore. And that's what she said. But listen to the words of Job. And what did Job respond to her? And he said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil? And all this Job did not say with his lips. Once again, there must have been a multitude of thousands upon thousands of angels who shouted, glory to God, praise Him. Great is our God. Great is the King. In praise for what God had done in the life of Job. But Job also shows great mercy. He doesn't tell his wife, you're an evil woman, you speak evil. What he told her is, you're speaking as one of the foolish women speak. And really what he's saying is, this is not you. This is not like you. You're speaking as one of those foolish people women speak who don't fear God. You're not like that. Don't speak that way. That's not you. He's showing her mercy too. So we don't really know what happened to Job, although we know further on down the story that God blessed Job with further children, and we know that Job actually in chapter 31 speaks about his wife briefly. So I have to take from that she didn't leave him. She didn't go away and walk off and go somewhere else. She's still there. He's still there. And still waiting and on God. And so we see these horrible things that have happened to Job. We see his terrific suffering and the pain that he has gone through. And yet through all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Job still held fast to his faith in God. Understand this too, that this is a time when this book didn't exist. Job couldn't read these things and take strength from them. Job didn't have any of that. Nobody did. All they had were I think, no doubt there were things written down, but there were no printing presses to spread them out and read them easily. He didn't have any of those valuable things that we now have. What Job had was word of mouth, and he had the Spirit who no doubt enlightened him and strengthened him and enabled him. And so as we see in verse 11 that Job had 3 friends that heard of all of it this evil that had come upon him, and they came each from his own place, Eliphaz and the Temanite, and Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. They made an appointment together to come and show him sympathy and comfort. And when they saw him from a distance, They did not recognize him, and they raised their voices and wept, and they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads and toward heaven. And they sat with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his suffering was very great. I think the tendency, as we go through you read the book of Job, the tendency is to take these three friends and then you put it in quotation marks. Yeah, some friends they were. I don't think that's fair. I think these were three good friends of Job. And really, there was a fourth one that came along, Elihu also, who I think turned out to be a great friend. These three men came to show Job sympathy and to comfort him. And yes, their advice, their understanding of what is going on was flawed for sure. And sometimes they're even very cruel in how they approached Job. But I think it's a serious mistake to think of these people as not true friends. No, these people were good friends, I believe. Because only a good friend would come and together and spend time to show sympathy and comfort for a friend, for someone who's suffering greatly. And when they saw him and they saw the depth of his suffering and the horribleness of the illness that he was suffering from, they could do nothing but cry for him. How amazing. They cried for him. And then they sat with him 7 days and seven nights and didn't say a word. And I think that many times, you know, when we go to comfort people, we think that we have to tell them something. We think that we have to school them a little bit on the providence of God and teach them some lesson that might strengthen them. And really the best thing we can do to help them is just to mourn with them, just to be with them and cry with them and sit and be with them that time. And that's exactly what they did. For 7 days and seven nights, they just sat with Job and they cried for him and they were just there with him. Those are good friends. But I think that, I'll move on a little bit here. I don't want to get into the discussions that they had with Job. Job would bring out the discussions. He would make the first comments, the first statements, and then his friends would then answer him. And it would go on. It'll go on for 34 chapters, they will argue. Eliphaz was the senior of the group of three that came over, or four. But Eliphaz was no doubt the senior man there, probably the oldest. And Bildad was next, and Zophar was after him. And so they'll get into a very lengthy discussion about why God is doing what he's doing. Think about that. Why is God doing what he is doing? Why is all these things happening to him? They didn't know. They didn't have that information. They didn't have this book to research, to give them insight. The only thing they could do was think about it and look around and try and understand the greatness and wisdom of God. But think about this too. Although they didn't have this book, not once did anybody say, well, God didn't do this. God wasn't involved in this. God couldn't do anything about this. Not once did that argument come up. They all knew exactly who did this. God did this. Even Job says that. God did this. Why, God, did you do this? That he did not know. But he did know who did it. He knew God did it. He might say, well, didn't Satan do that? Didn't God give Satan the power? You go out and do this. No, Satan is on a leash. And Satan only does what God allows him to do. Satan does exactly what God allows him to do and no more than that. And God said, you may do this, knowing exactly what he would do. Therefore, God is the one who's responsible for this. God did this and no other. He's the one who did it. And there was no discussion about that. There's no debate about that at all. There would be a big debate these days whether that happened. And some would very angrily said, oh no, God would never do that. God would never have anything involved with the death of innocent people or suffering to people who did not deserve it. God would never do such a thing. But they all knew that that was not so, that he's the King of Kings, and he's the Lord of Lords. He does what he wills. The problem that they had, the issue that they had was, why? Why did you do these things? And that's a good question. That's a timely question. He didn't know that. And I think what one of the great mercies of this book, one of the great things about the experience of Job is that he gives an answer. He answers those things. So a multitude of saints throughout the ages then could read about that and understand it and know, oh, God is glorious, and what God does is good. And it may seem horrible, and it is sometimes, and it's painful. And the testing is hard, but God is good. And they can see that in the book. But they didn't have that information. They didn't know that. And so when our trials come to us, when we're presented with testings and these things happen to us, what we need to understand is that these things are of universal importance. The most important events that happen in the world are when God's children reverence Him and praise Him and worship Him, even in the face of suffering. These things are the most important things in the world. Right now, we live in a strange age. We're seeing things go on that amaze us. The depth of the sin and disparity, the things that are going on all around us, and we think, wow, these things are great. These things are important. But I'm telling you, there is nothing more important than when God's children reverence Him and take glory in Him and worship Him. Nothing is more important than that. Nothing. We see, we hear now of a Supreme Court justice who has died and she's going to be replaced, and we hope by somebody who's so much better than her, and by a conservative. You think, wow, these are important things. These are great things. God must surely be watching this. The angels must surely be watching this thing that's happening. And if Trump picks somebody who does a good job, they're all going to shout in praise. No, they won't. They shout in praise for a sinner who repents. They shout in praise for a child of God who worships the King even in the midst of their suffering. That's what they shout in praise of. That's what's important. That's what's earth-shaking. Not what happens in the elections. Not what happens to a Supreme Court nominee. These are the things that we need to remember when God's people, like the psalmist says in the 63rd Psalm, the steadfast love of the Lord is better than life. That's what is important. That's what's dramatic and big in the world. And then they remember that when our trials come upon us and our testings come upon us, remember that these things are a battleground. They're not something that's trivial or small. And we're all tested. We're all going to go through our trials and our tribulations. If we're a child of God, it's coming. It's either coming or has come, and it probably will come again. We'll all be tested. We'll all suffer trials, and we're all going to go through them. But we have to remember that these things are our battleground. We look at we often think of missionaries, you know, out in the jungle and serving God. We say they're out there on the battleground. They're the ones fighting. I'm here in America where life is easy and there's lots of wealth and nice retirements and all those nice things are coming. We think, well, I'm not on the battleground. Oh, yes, you are. When God tests you, when He tries you, when He causes things to happen to you to test your faith, you're in a battle now with Him. You're in a battle. And what you do, how you respond to those things, might bring great glory. And so think about it that way when our testing comes. And then also notice that Satan is a very vicious, and he's a clever enemy. He's vicious, and he's clever, and he knows how to deceive us. The heart is deceitfully wicked. Who could know it? Satan uses that. He knows how to push our buttons. He knows how to cause us to react. He knows how to get to us. He knows just the right things to do. He knows just when to do it. And so he will attack us, but he can be defeated. And I think it's noteworthy when as I read through Job quite a while back, one of the things that jumped out at me was in the very first response of Eliphaz when he's responding to Job's comments. Eliphaz tells about a very interesting experience that he had that I think sets the tone of what his argument would be, and also what Bildad and Zophar's argument would be throughout their discourse with Job. Eliphaz says in chapter 4, verse 12, he says, "Now a word was brought to me stealthily or secretly. My ear received the whisper of it. Amid thoughts from visions of the night, when deep sleep falls on men, dread came upon me and trembling, which made all my bones shake. A spirit glided past my face. The hair of my flesh stood up, and it stood still. The spirit stood still. But I could not discern its appearance. A form was before my eyes. There was silence. And then I heard a voice. And the voice said, 'Can mortal man be in the right before God? Can a man be pure before his Maker? Even in his servants he puts no trust. And his angels he charges with error. How much more those who dwell in houses of clay, whose foundation is in the dust, who are crushed like the moth between morning and evening. They are beaten to pieces. They perish forever without anyone regarding it. Is not their tent cord plucked up within them? Do they not die and without wisdom?'" Job had a very interesting experience here. As I studied this out, it seemed to me that this clearly is not a word from God, as Eliphaz took it. I said Job, as Eliphaz took it. This, I believe, is a demon or Satan speaking with him. This is Satan, I believe, implanting in Eliphaz's mind a thought that you can see come out in Eliphaz's arguments throughout their discussions, and also Bildad and Zophar. You can see it come out in their discussions with Job. This very thought. There are several things about this that to me point a picture of Satan or a demon saying this. It does not sound like God, and I won't go into the reasons for that so much as that look at the message that it says. It's not a truthful message. Do men die without God noticing it, without any notice of that at all? Notice the anger, I suppose you might say, that he does not even trust his angels. Who might that message be from? I think that's from Satan himself. I think that Satan has done everything he can to do a work to cause error on the thought process of Job, and using his friends in this way. Now, what I'm saying is that his friends would come, and his friends would argue that Job, the problem is you have sinned. And that's really boiling down their argument that Job, you sinned, obviously, because good things happen to good people, bad things happen to bad people. So you have sinned, you've done a terrible sin, must have been a horrible sin, or sins, and you're hiding these things, and this is why this is happening to you. I don't think that Satan is trying to convince Job that he has sinned. Satan is very well, he knows very well that Job knows who he is, and he knows very well that Job knows, you know, he did not sin. I'm not harboring, Job's not saying he's perfect. What Job is not harboring some awful thing that he's doing in his life that nobody really knows about, that God is judging him for. Job knows that, and Satan knows that Job knows that. So what kind of a message, what is Satan up to when he implants this thought process in the mind of Eliphaz which will come out in their arguments? And I think what's going on here is Satan is trying to caused Job to think that, God, you're unfair. You're mean. You're cruel. I take no joy in you. And that is, in fact, what Satan always does with pain. When we have pain in our testing that comes upon us, Satan's goal is to show that God is hostile or maybe powerless. Powerless would not have worked in Job's day, but it worked very well now. That God is either cruel and mean, and that's what I think Satan is trying to get Job to think, that God is cruel to him. You're mean to me. I have worshipped you. I have desired your honor and your glory, and I'm careful about all that I do. I'm kind to people. I treat them well. I reflect your spirit in my life. I do these things, and yet I'm suffering greatly, clearly under the hand of God. I think Satan's intention is to make Job think that God is cruel and mean to him. And Satan uses those things. These days it would be very easy to convince people, and in fact they'll often tell you that God has no power, that when bad things happen to people, when people die, when people suffer, when children die, when accidents happen, that clearly it was not God it would do, because God would not do those sorts of things to people. And they become very angry if you would say that, no, God controls all things. We live and breathe in Him. Every molecule that floats in the air is designed and guided by God. He does it all. And then Satan uses wealth and health and pleasures to show us that God is unnecessary. And I think that's worked quite well in our modern age. There is a great deal of wealth and health and good things. And so who needs God? I have that without Him. I don't need Him for those things. And he wants to use pleasure and health and family and those things as our joy. So what Satan is up to is to make us believe, to cause us to think that our joy is in anything else but God. And yet what did Job do? He said, no, my joy is in Him. In Him I worship, no matter what happened to me. In my great sorrow of all the things that He took from me, and my great pain and injury, I'll do nothing but worship Him and wait on Him. So God's aim then is to cause us to find our joy and our satisfaction, our fulfillment, our desires in Him. That's what He's after. That's what He wants us to do. So when our suffering comes and we're hurt and we're in pain and we're suffering loss, it's to cause us to see that these things are temporary. They're nothing to us. He is everything to us. He is our joy. He is our satisfaction. He is our all in all. So if you take it all from me, all my wealth, all my retirement, all my security, my home, everything from me, if you take my family from me, even if you take my health from me, I still have you and I still have my joy in you. And so in you I will trust and in you I will wait. And that's what God's aim is to do. That's what we are to learn when we go through our trials, through our testings, and through our sufferings, that He is all in all to us, that He is our joy and He is our strength, and that He is good. He's a good God. And one day we'll see great glory in these things, and we'll see that, I think, I hope, in part two, next week. So we take glory in God even in the midst of our suffering. So.